This week on Trek, Marry, Kill, Introns, Venom, Spot, next.
From the darkest age of time,
well,
a primeval terror is unleashed.
Deanna, what's happening? She is no longer human.
And a deadly transformation has begun.
I believe the crew is de-evolving.
Now, who will survive?
How do we reverse the process?
I'm uncertain.
And who will fall victim to this savage nightmare? Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Trek, Marry, Kill.
Hi, I'm Brian.
Hi, I'm Heidi.
Welcome to Trek, Marry, Kill, a podcast trying to answer questions about which episodes of Star Trek belong in the canon before it devolves into a lemur and begins swinging through the ship looking for breakfast. Joining me this week to look at another one of Star Trek's big swings is actor, writer, producer Heidi Cox, creator of the web series Stalking LeVar. She's also the founder of Dweeb Darlings, a production company that creates and produces media made by women. Heidi, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I was introduced to you through Katie Hampton, who's been a co-host on our show a couple of times.
Nice.
And highly recommended. But also when, Stalking LeVar, like, I'm going to ask this question I ask all of our guests. Like, seems like you've been into Star Trek for quite a long time, or a reading rainbow. I don't know.
So. Oh, both for sure. Both, but yeah, I love specifically TNG. Like, that was the one that I really fell in love with. I mean, I'm really enjoying Strange New Worlds now, but TNG was the one that I was like obsessed with growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you a big Geordi LaForge head then? Just,
Sure. Honestly, I was more of a Data.
He was
my favorite because what was the joke I used to tell? You know, emotional unavailability is so appealing, right? So, but you know, and I always like in the original series, I always loved Spock too. So there's something intriguing about those personalities. But of course, I love Geordi LaForge because LeVar Burton. Hello, like he's such a
wonderful,
pleasant energy, right?
Yes, and I've mentioned this already a couple of times, listeners. Sorry, but like when I was on the picket lines and he was there, just mm-hmm. could feel the aura just radiating off of him. And he dropped that smile and was like, oh, it's real. It's not just on camera. It's,
right.
It follows him everywhere. This week, we're looking at Genesis, the 19th episode of Star Trek The Next Generation's 7th season. It debuted in syndication March 21st, 1994. So here we are. It's 30th anniversary, which is absolutely wild. I remember clear as day watching this episode in syndication. It was written by Brandon Braga, directed by Dr. Crusher herself, Gates McFadden. I'll have a little bit more on that in a bit. Memory Alpha describes it. Enterprise crew members de-evolve into prehistoric creatures after a medical treatment by Dr. Crusher goes awry. Memory Alpha doesn't tell us that this episode is actually kind of like a Barclay episode, or at least he's the cause for what's going on. His Dr. Crusher's medical treatment of his basically anxiety about a slight elevation in some hormones is what causes an airborne pathogen that causes everyone to de-evolve. Do you remember the first time you saw this episode?
I saw that you were going to ask me that, and I actually don't remember the first time I saw it. But I got to tell you, like, I binged a ton of episodes when I was younger. Like, when I someone had them recorded, and I just remember being like, and like I was just consuming them. So but I mean, once I rewatched it last night just to kind of refresh my memory, I was like, oh yeah, I remember this. It's a really cool episode.
It's a lot of fun. Especially in season 7, which I think is generally speaking kind of a rough one in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think everyone was really tired. I don't think they did a really good job of shepherding that writing staff and like bringing in some fresh voices. So you get a lot of kind of tired arms, to use a baseball reference, a lot of tired arms in the bullpen. But
yeah.
this one definitely stood out to me for reasons I'm going to explain in a moment. It's stayed very fresh in my mind for 30 years.
That's pretty cool.
So just to get into why I haven't forgotten it in 30 years, which even though we're saying it's fun, there's one of the most horrifying memory moments in all of Star Trek, at least for me personally. I think most people think the most terrifying beat in Star Trek history is probably the earworm in Star Trek II. That scene, probably number one.
It's pretty gross.
Personally, this is my number two. when Worf sprays Dr. Crusher in the face with venom. We went out to like family dinner right after that. I watched it on TV and I was ashen and just sitting at the table like, because you rarely see something so violent. And then one of our main characters, you know, I'm 13 and Dr. Crusher's kicking and screaming in agony. And it's very real. So I credit to the episode that they made the stakes seem so visceral and real.
Oh, she really committed to that. I remember I was just watching it last night. I was like, damn, Gates. Okay. She's an actress. So she really like fully, I was like, but in my mind, I'm like, oh, it's a good way to get her off camera so she can direct, you know.
Perfect way. I think she was like, guys, since I'm directing one of these, can you make sure I'm written out of it? And they're like, say no more, fam. We got you. Yeah. We'll get you out of there real fast. Yeah.
For me, the horrifying moment was when Worf like bites Deanna. Like,
yeah, that's pretty
sexual assault. Hello. Like, I'm like, oh man, like,
yeah,
back off, bro.
Yep. Exactly.
But, you know, back then, and then also being devolved and all that.
Right. Like, he was just being extremely Klingon in that moment. But yes. And we're definitely going to talk about that because I've definitely got that in one of the grades, that particular moment. Right. But before we do that, I wanted to talk a little bit more about Gates McFadden directing this episode because, you know, let's face it, Star Trek historically, especially behind the scenes, has not really treated women very well. And I think I want to give not just credit, but like just to really paint the picture here. Gates McFadden was fired after season one of Next Generation because of men not liking her, bringing up very fair points about how women were treated, portrayed, paid, etc. on the show.
Yeah.
And she's always stayed true to who she is. So, I mean, it's a genuine credit to her that not only is she fired, she comes back to the show and then she eventually directs. You mentioned that she's an actor. Well, she's also, in all those years when she was acting before, during, and since, or after, oh, she's still acting now, but she's a teacher. She teaches acting. She teaches clown. She teaches, you know, she teaches a lot of stuff. She's run theaters, set them up, done shows herself. So this is all like, this is not the same as Jonathan Frakes insofar as Jonathan Frakes had to do basically 300 hours or two seasons of learning how to be a TV director. I mean, Gates McFadden is an artist through and through. She's been doing this a lot. I'm sure she had to do a lot of self-advocating just to agitate to get to this point. I'm sure her child had to be of a certain age at some point where she felt comfortable doing the extra time to prep and then do posting on it. And so it all worked out, but I think it's a little bit of a bummer too, in that we kind of missed out on some other great, well-directed episodes by Gates McFadden, to say nothing of women in Star Trek. And I have another note about that later, but you are a woman who directs in Hollywood in the 21st century. And so instead of me just mansplaining Gates McFadden, I guess if you could, Len, just talk about, like, not to like tell men how things are, but just your view of directing. When you say I'm a woman who directs, do people just go, great, or is there a thing?
No, I think, I mean, especially, honestly, first of all, have you ever met her?
No.
No. She is a force of nature.
I believe it.
Her and Marina both, like, just really amazing personalities and really know how, like, they use their voice and they advocate for themselves. And I am not surprised at all that she managed to get that done. It sucks that it took her until the seventh season. But directing is something that I've sort of eased into, but I usually get positive responses from that. I'm an actor first, but the more I wrote, the more I produced, the more I wanted to direct. And my husband's a director, like, which is kind of cool because I can sort of confer with him about different ideas and things that I have. He loves comics. Like, his podcast is called Geekscape. And, like, he grew up reading comics, so, like, he sees storyboards in his mind all the time, I think, just from reading all those. But, yeah, I think I'm lucky because I've come after a lot of that, like, a lot of what, like, Gates McFadden and other women have had to deal with. But even then, like, you hear it from even female actresses where they could win an Oscar but still don't get offered something amazing afterwards that's worth, like, that they're getting paid what they're worth. So, like, I've heard female directors I can't remember if it was, I feel like it might have been Halle Berry. It's like, well, I've directed this thing, I made this thing. And then it takes like 10 years later before they're offered or able to direct something else. A really good friend of mine, America Young, is directing a good bit of TV. So it is happening. I mean, and the Warner Brothers Directors Apprenticeship Program has recently had several groups of women that they've really focused on, especially women of color and things like that. So I really think that the industry is trying to push that forward because it is a different gaze. It's a different perspective. I mean, you know, you're going to bring it up later, but the fact that like Marina is in clothes when she's in the bathtub, like that's a female gaze thing as opposed to a male gaze thing. And I think that those things are important and they make a difference in what we see and how we look at storytelling and the world and treat one another with equality and respect. I don't know. Did that answer your question at all?
Yeah. Because I think it's worth talking about because in my mind, in my experience producing and being on many, many sets and dealing with pre-production that I'm a guy, so I'm just talking to the guys out there, I guess, especially the ones that may not think they're sexist, but are when they hear a woman director, they have a reaction. To me, you can boil the job of directing down to, and I know that relationships and personalities and communication are important, but it really is, you have to make more decisions than your imagination can fathom. Mm-hmm. That like, if you don't know what being a director is, and even if you don't want to be one, just to know what it is, the top line is, you make every decision, which means that when you, even some directors will be like, I hire people to do the jobs I think they can do. But 9 times out of 10, a really smart production designer is going to bring you more choices than you could ever think of, unless you are able to communicate very clearly, like, this is what I'm going for, make decisions in this pocket or whatever. Yeah. So, you know, I guess in a sexist way, I'm saying, like, in my mind, my experience is that women are more than capable of making multiple decisions, simultaneous decisions in a lot of ways. I think sometimes men, especially as we get older, we get locked into, it's hard for us to juggle two things at the same time. So if you're trying to deal with a scene, let's say, but someone brings you a costume thing, your brain has to kind of shut down and focus. Mm-hmm. So in my, just from an efficiency standpoint, I'm like, not even just the POV, which is as important. It's like, women should be directing because women are as fundamental, foundational to making things as men are.
Yeah, they're over half the population.
Yeah, exactly.
I think also in that same wheelhouse, even as like a producer, when I was like, I guess stalking LeVar, I was technically like the showrunner or whatever. It's, you do think about how you're able to be assertive. And it's almost like women, we often think about, okay, I have to say this really nicely, or people are going to say, oh, she's a bitch, or, you know, and if a man did the same thing, they'd be like, oh, he's just really, you know, assertive and he knows what he wants. But if a woman is like that, a lot of times it's like this, not to, I don't know, like patriarchy society just sort of looks at it like, oh, she's not sweet, she's not calm, she's not whatever, you know. And it does cross your mind when you're a woman and you're in like a position of quote authority or decision making like that. Okay, how am I coming across? Am I going to piss anyone off? Are they, what are they going to say? Is it going to affect the performances? Is it going to affect how people follow my direction? You have to think about that. Absolutely. And I kind of hate that you do.
I think that's kind of what I was trying to get towards. And I think for Gates McFadden, it probably was the best case scenario was that it was an existing cast member whom, as far as I can tell, every cast member liked to loved her. Like she had a good relationship with everybody so that it was easier for her to then suddenly be in the chair calling all the shots. There was a comfort there. But yeah, I think it does seem like that men are they're always looking for a reason to write a woman off. And that's agitating. It's upsetting is a kind of where I was getting at with that.
I think it's more of like a reflex. It's more like they don't even know they're looking for that. I think it's just something that's sort of built into society and is getting better. So, one thing I was going to say too, not only is Gates McFadden a teacher and an actress and a director, but she is also a dancer.
Yes.
It's like amazing choreographer as well. So, and I remember that episode where Data's trying to learn how to dance.
Oh yeah. She's the dancing doctor, literally, for sure. Yeah.
She taught him how to tap dance at first. Like it was so cool. I was like, oh, that's cool that she, I don't know if she was like, hey, I can tap dance if you want to throw that in there anywhere, you know, or something, or if they just knew.
Right. But they might have, because she was like, I'm sick of just being the mom and the doctor.
Yeah, I mean, and a few episodes, what, she was, one season she was pregnant, wasn't she? Where you could kind of tell how they were shooting it. I thought that
I'm sure that's what happened for sure.
Yeah, the lab.
Yes, just to close the loop on the directing part of this, mm-hmm. it's just something worth pointing out for all the progressiveness of the Star Trek universe. All that largely has been in front of the camera. It has been very rare that it's behind the camera. Basically,
tight uniform.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Beard. Even Major Keir is wearing a cat suit. Everyone always focuses on Seven of Nine, but then I was thinking the other day, I'm like, well, what Major Keir gets the brown tan one in Deep Space Nine's run? So it's everywhere when you see it. And like, basically, once the staff can only carry one woman writer at a time, you know, it's just bizarre to think about it.
Yeah. a director that I worked with, a female director I worked with on like a Lifetime movie years ago, she actually, I think, directed the first few episodes of Picard, like when it first came out.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Annalee Culpepper.
Yes. Directed the shit out of them, by the way. There is awesome. Fantastic, by the way. Yeah, she's great.
I love working with her.
And so just to mention a little bit more about her directing on the Star Trek cruise, which just landed back in the U.S. As of this recording, Gates McFadden was on board that cruise, and she did a live commentary screening of Genesis, of this episode. So I'm just pulling this from TrekMovie.com's write-up. I promise it's not very much. It's just one little section. I'm not sure if it's because the full accounting has more details or if it didn't wind up being, you know, too revelatory or too all that interesting, but she did point out that she wanted some stylistic changes to be made to the set and story to give the creepy feel that the episode is what we know it for. So unlike the rest of the series, when the Enterprise is clean and shiny, she wanted to shock everybody by having Picard and Data return to a ship that was dark, dirty, and broken. It's not nearly as dark or dirty as she wanted it to be, but it's still quite a contrast. And like you said, she was also responsible for getting the script changed so that Counselor Troi is found in the bathtub after Counselor Troi has de-evolved into an amphibian. But she's fully clothed and not naked, as the script originally called for. And to the dancer point, there's kind of a nimbleness with the camera in the teaser, the way it's almost basically a oneer, kind of bouncing around between all the medical issues. She goes from Riker, then the Barclay, and then Data comes in, and there's kind of a light movement between all that, a dance, if you will. So
there is, you're right, that's so cool. I think they were always looking for opportunities to have Marina be unclothed or in something tight, or you know, like the ratings, the lower cut tops and all that stuff. I heard her say that once. So
I mean, that's the burden of being the hottest member in the cast, probably, I would imagine.
I mean, I think her and Gates were like equally hot, though. Like, they both were.
It's a question hot. For the ages, which we will not answer. Solve here. Specific thoughts that I want to get into before we get to the grades. This episode won an Emmy Award for Outstanding Individual Achievement in Sound Mixing for a Drama Series. It was also nominated for Outstanding Individual Achievement in Sound Editing for a Series, an Outstanding Individual Achievement in Makeup for a Series, and it did not win. Oh, that's kind of a robbery.
Rarely won back then. I remember I always was watching, wanting them to like win. Or I remember watching, like, maybe not always, but I remember watching and looking it up to see like if they had won anything. They would always be nominated. It was never for anything like best ensemble cast or best actors. It was always like special effects stuff. Or
it got a perfunctory amazing. Best drama in its final season. A perfunctory, it was like basically like a Lifetime Achievement Award. No one would argue the seventh season was its best season except for the finale. but you know, to the idea, like, they never won, I think, because somehow Star Trek got boiled down to it's just a bunch of people with forehead appliances on. But this episode legitimately doesn't have that, which is all the more astounding. So Michael Westmore, who's the makeup guru, he described his work in this episode as proving to be his greatest challenge because everybody mutated. He says, we never would have been ready if the episode hadn't miraculously fallen right after Christmas. We worked through the holiday. And a list of the de-evolved crew members. So you had, basically, this is Memory Alpha, so they're going full nerd, but they find that snake skin. We don't see anyone in makeup. It's just a sleeve. Of course, Michael Dorn becomes a proto Klingon. So Deanna Troi, Counselor Marina Sirtis, becomes the amphibian. Commander Riker becomes Australopithecine, Cro-Magnon man, basically. Apparently, Livingston, Picard's lionfish, de-evolved into a jellyfish. I don't remember seeing that.
I didn't see it. Mm-hmm.
Spot turned into an iguana. Barclay turned in- Barclay turns into a spider, which is cool and creepy. Nurse Gawa turns into an ape-like humanoid. And props to the actress who plays Alyssa Ogawa. I'm blanking on her name right now. But she starts doing the ape stuff early in the episode. She starts talking slower too. But then, she swings her fists when she's walking. And then one more makeup effect. It's not a de-evolved person, but it wasn't a forehead appliance. The poor red shirt who gets slashed and killed, he has like a cool death effect, ripping effect.
Yeah. What I noticed was that she, in the ready room when they're having that little meeting, she takes her fists and rests her knuckles on the on the table, and like she's walking around with them.
And she's getting very close to going talking. It's pretty cool. So a couple of more factoids here. Star Trek 101, A Practical Guide to Who, What, Where, and Why is a reference book written by Paula M. Block and Terry J. Erdman. These people have written about Star Trek many times over the years, but this book released in 2008, which is to serve as an introduction to the Star Trek universe, ranked this episode as one of the worst in TNG. A staggering discovery by me, because I can't believe someone would say it's one of the worst. It got the Spock's Brain Medal for TNG. I couldn't believe it. And then this episode marks the fifth and final appearance of Reg Barclay, played by Dwight Schultz, on the series. We, of course, see him again in First Contact, and then he appears in a bunch of Voyagers. And then I just want to point out this cute little callback. Brandon Braga in the previous season had written the episode Realm of Fear, and that's the one where Barclay has that fear of being in the transporter, and he sees those dune worms in the transporter beam with him. And he's talking about his fears in the episode, and he happens to mention that he's not afraid of spiders. Spiders never bothered him. And then in this episode, he becomes a spider. So I thought that was cute.
Yeah, that's a fun little Easter egg, right? You gotta love Barclay and all his neuroses to push a plot forward. I do not care for, I'm very afraid of spiders. So that when I saw them go down into engineering and there was web everywhere, I was like, oh, right, ugh, gross. Like, yeah. I was so glad he didn't come out of the, the chamber that
the warp core.
Yeah, I was like, stay in there. Like, yeah. But yeah. You know what? One thing that bothered me, can we go back to when you were talking about Spot being turned into iguana?
Yeah.
The only thing that bothered me was like, they never really paid off the whole thing with the kittens. I was like, are the kittens okay?
Oh, those kittens are going to die. They weren't fed in the first 24 hours.
Right. So
there's no way they survived.
Did they die? I didn't, like, I was like, oh, I should watch the next episode just to see if they.
Oh, there's no continuity there. There are no Spot's kittens.
That bums me out.
Spot's gender has changed in the show. May not even be the original Spot. We don't know. Oh, yeah, sure. So Spot might have died after the transformation back. We don't know. So
it's a funny name for a cat, too, because most of the time people name dogs Spot.
I think that was part of the joke.
Yeah,
was absolutely. That Data's not quite getting the point of it. Yeah.
That's why we love him.
Yep. Should we get into the grades then?
Let's do it.
All right. So great scenes. If you would like to start us off, what did you think was the first great scene?
I just for like the comedy of it and the acting, I really liked Worf and Deanna in 10 Forward, and he's like stuffing his face. And she's drinking the water, and neither of them are like, what the hell is wrong with you? Why are you acting like a weirdo? You know, they're both just being weird. And it's just funny to watch him just like throw food and like stuff in. And I remember thinking to myself, Michael Dorn must be having the best time shooting this scene, eating all the weird like squid legs and just like tossing it down. I thought that was like, just for like the content, really great.
No, I mean, he's being a pig and she's being the dainty olive caviar and I'm cold. And he's like, caviar for lunch. Yeah. She's being very dainty.
Thanks for waiting.
Yes, because they're by this point, they are dating. That's kind of building on that. I definitely had that scene, too, because it's part of the whole sequence of their violent courtship, I guess. Before that, though, I did like the scene where the driver for this episode, or the solve, is because Picard and Data are off the ship. They're off the ship because a bad field test for the new defense system. So they have to go retrieve a stray torpedo. But before they leave, Data entrusts Lieutenant Barclay with caring for Spot while he's away, because it could take a few days. So I really like that scene. Of course, Barclay's a cat boy. And he's and it's funny that Spot's the only member of the Enterprise crew other than Data that Spot likes, doesn't run from or attack. And mm-hmm. then they find Spot's hiding spot where he intends to have the kittens. And then you have that conspiratorial scene where Barclay goes, "Who's the father?" And Data's like, "I'm going to do a full genetic analysis once these kids. There's only 12 male cats aboard the ship. I don't know how Spot got out." But
and I'm like, why are they not like. Why are they not fixing these cats? Also?
That's true. That's true.
What's
that? That's right. That's right. Just imagine Picard on the intercom. Help control the pet population.
Spay and neuter. It's like Bob Barker.
Any other great scenes? I mean, there's
that was a really good one that you said. Like, I did like that one too, because I just thought that was really funny. But I don't know. I mean, I thought that the whole thing flowed really well. I almost didn't even divide it into scenes. I mean,
yeah, no, I think that's a great point.
I liked like when they come back to the ship, like even before they board it, how it's just turning.
Yes. You know, when they discover the ship adrift. Yeah. It's kind of a,
and then they say the thing that happens in like, even in that movie Interstellar, where it's like, you have to match the spin of the, the ship to dock and all that. But I mean, I think that was a cool effect, because you really don't see the Enterprise adrift that often.
No, it's kind of scary on its own right, that the Enterprise mm-hmm. is suddenly haunted. It's like a haunted house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, too. Totally.
I mean, yeah, and for me, I get a little snobby when it comes to great scenes. I like great. I mean, there are great moments, but I also think a scene has to have like a dramatically important thrust to it. So sure. Like I thought the scene where Worf finally comes in and bites Deanna in the tub, you know, because it's what you said about the other scene. What's so great about it is we as the audience are being like, what's going on? This is weird and upsetting. But it's kind of like Michael Dorn and Marina Sirtis are almost playing it not campily, but they're playing it straight. And because it's what their characters are, Worf is basically a big brute, and she's turning. She doesn't know what's going on to her. She's just cold. That it's funny, but it's unsettling. And then they just launch into Worf's checking out the server. Right. And that's where he gets the idea. He locks in on Deanna Troi. Right. He sees the boobs right in his face. That's how it was shot. And then when the boobs leave, he's staring right at Deanna and he's like, I must have her. And then he goes into her and bites her. And then that leads us into the sickbay scene where Dr. Crusher notices the sack on Worf's face. And she goes, Worf, how long have you had this? And he's looking at her like an idiot. And then she says, Worf, open your mouth. And he understands that. And he sprays her with venom, and she grabs her face and she screams in horror like she's dying, because she is. And that was the moment Brian has never forgotten.
13-year-old Brian couldn't eat his dinner.
I still wound up having a banana cream pie. The place we went to had a great banana cream pie. I couldn't turn that down. But I was still very shaken by it. And I think it was a great scene. It's a great bit of tension. You know, I think the 10 forward scene is weird. The bathtub moment is like, oh my God. Also, she's in the tub in her uniform. There's something creepier about that. It was like a great note that she's not naked, that she's in her uniform, letting the water flow over her. And then I thought the next great scene was Data and Picard discover Spot's kittens and Spot has turned into a lizard.
I'm so worried about the kittens. I felt so awful.
I think the kittens are dead. I don't think they make it. But I like the scene because it's like a good. Oh, remember, it's Star Trek. All this is like very. They come back to a haunted ship. They're finding molted skin. Like goo is dripping down. Like bile is dripping off of stuff. They hear animal noises everywhere. You know, and then they find the kittens. And then there's an iguana, and it's like, wait, what's going on? It's like, oh, right, we're in Star Trek. He's using the tricorder. There's a thing that's going on. They figure out what they have to do.
And they use that scene to figure out how they can heal the rest of the crew, but they don't seem even concerned about the kittens. They're like, okay, let's go. Let's go find the nurse because she's pregnant. And I'm like, you're rude leaving those kids. I mean, it's the 24th century. There's got to be a way to feed them, like, without.
I just think it's been so long. Like, we recently had to help with a kitten that got left behind. Mm-hmm. And when they get separated and they don't get fed or they're not with the mom, it's really touch and go. And then, you know, so how is Spot going to re-evolve and then bond with them? That's all very questionable. I don't trust the crew of the USS Enterprise to really have a good vet section.
That makes me sad. I mean, and I'm not even like, I'm allergic to cats, but I still was worried about those kittens. I was just like, thanks for moving the story along. All right, let's go.
I got to be honest that as a 13-year-old, you don't even think about the long term with the cats now. Now that scene plays totally differently when you're older. And I think the culture at large has a little bit more understanding about domestic animals, that it's like, oh, that's a very bad. It's not just bad that they haven't been fed by her, but that they haven't been fed in almost a day.
That's horrible. I'm surprised they're still alive.
Right. I thought the sequence where Picard then has to draw Worf away from sick bay, and it's basically just a monster movie. Mm-hmm. You've got a proto Klingon spraying venom, getting at the doors. And
And then the part with the electricity. That was super smart of him. He insulated himself first and then he electrocuted him. He's like,
yeah. Even though Picard's de-evolving into like a lemur or something, he still has enough of his mind that he can do that. But, you know, directing a horror movie, a monster movie in the corridors of the Enterprise, I think it was all very smart, using all of the Buffalo, basically. Like, if the crew de-evolved, what would that look like? Oh, we've got a Klingon on board, a de-evolved Klingon. That's basically like the monster that they have to defeat. And who's the worst, like, let's put a frightful old man running from him. Like, the jeopardy could not be higher. So I thought that was great.
Yeah.
Best Trek tropes. How about weird virus?
Yeah. Okay. That's a good point. Weird virus is always I didn't feel like there were a lot of like push-ins on Picard on this one. So yeah. That's a trope for me with that.
Oh, when they push in on him? Yeah.
Right before the act break, you know.
Yeah, but sure.
Yeah, yeah, weird virus. There's always something like that.
I like this better than the drunk virus and like the naked now and all that stuff. And it's definitely one of the most high concept ones that they've had. And it's an interesting idea. I kind of liked it. Any others that you want to throw out? If not, you can just say, let's move on.
I don't know.
Okay.
I should have like written some stuff down while I was watching it.
It's okay.
I literally watched it last night. I was like, I gotta rewatch this thing. It didn't feel as tropey to me because it's such a unique episode. Like, it's so different.
I agree. And it kind of flows, like you said. So there's not a lot of like, you know, the tropes are, you know, could get minuscule in that Data is able to use the tricorder and they're able to make leaps of logic to figure this, this, and that out. But if you wanted to mention it, fine. But weird virus, that's the one.
I mean, there is the fact that like Captain Picard insists on going in the shuttlecraft to go get the torpedo, which is dumb, like, because he's the captain.
Well, we got to figure out, maybe that's a worse one, but it could be a best one because every so often Picard does like to trot out the, you know, I am a good pilot. Something they've mentioned before. So maybe that's a good best Trek trope. It actually is the thing. But there was a version where it's like, why is he so not interested in sticking around for a few days?
Yeah.
Like, they don't really get into that ennui that might have been in there.
He's like, bye.
Yeah, exactly. Peace out. I'm taking the ops officer, literally one of the most important crew members, with me. Figure it out.
Third in command. Yeah. Come on, let's go.
Worst Trek tropes.
Worst Trek tropes. And this one?
I have three.
Klingons biting people, I guess.
You don't like it when they do? Yeah, okay. Klingon customs. All right.
I gotta be honest, I don't really like Klingons at all. I think they're kind of funny, but they just seem like douchey assholes. I've just never really been into the language. Is that okay?
Well, we're an explicit tag podcast.
So okay.
You can say all you want.
I'm not saying that I don't enjoy a Klingon storyline, but usually, especially when I was younger, a Klingon storyline was always kind of like... for me.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, but I mean, I know a lot of the dudes like it. They're like, yeah, ooh, Klingons, bro-y, ooh, gonna fight. So I don't know, the Klingon customs, yeah, just him.
That's fighting. A good one. That's so, a good one.
What about you?
The three I have are, I'll go in reverse order. Actually, I had four. Hold on. So oh, wow. Red shirts getting a couple of lines, but then the red shirt dying. Ooh, yeah. And sometimes it's fun, like when we see them die, it can be like as a show of the enemy's powers, it can be fine. But in this one, it's like he gets a couple of lines remembering Riker, you know, reminding Riker, hey, dipshit, we've got to report into Starfleet. Mm-hmm. But then he just gets unceremoniously just slashed by one of his fellow crew members, which the episode does not deal with, you know, and he's just murdered sitting at his post. That sucks. Yeah. Drafting off of that, the consequences of dress. So as much as I put the weird virus as the best Trek trope, the worst is the consequences of that. I can kind of buy that they were able to get Dr. Crusher into stasis so that she didn't just die from the venom, and then they'll just put her face perfectly back because it's Star Trek. I can kind of buy that enough, but I have a really hard time believing that Riker is Riker again after he re-evolves and his brain grows back, because that stuff got deleted, destroyed. So it didn't shrink. Like, it didn't scale down. It got destroyed. Yeah. Like, so this isn't like resizing a Photoshop. It's not going to just snap, or like, you know, what is a vector graphic? It's not going to go back and be 100%. He's not Riker anymore.
Gotta rebuild those neural pathways.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So there's just that kind of stuff. And like when cartilage tears, cartilage does not grow back. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of overtime for the medical staff, I think.
Also, I'm sure they have contraptions that do it. But
yes. You know. Also, if Dr. Crusher is in stasis, does that mean she's not de-evolving? So then they never had the thought of putting the crew in stasis until someone could figure it out and like leave a note for Data to be like, hey. Now I think maybe the answer is like this just happened before anyone could figure any of that out. That makes sense.
Well, but, and she's also not de-evolving, she's directing, so
that's... she's evolving in fact, Brian.
BRB directing this that's episode right.
And just the idea that there are no protocols for airborne diseases. And this is before Dr. Crusher gets put in stasis. The chief medical officer calls in the entire medical staff from their other rotations because she's like, it's clear something's going around. And then there's no protocols enforced, no isolation, no masks, no screenings, nothing. Because even though she gets sprayed in the face with the venom, Nurse O'Gowan was right there when she gave the command. She called in Dr. Salar. You know what I mean? So, whatever. And then the last one, it's in here, but it's a long running TNG trope of Worf getting shut down. He usually gets denied. He's like, we should attack. And they're like, no, Worf. No, no, no. But here they're like negging him because the photon torpedoes don't work. And they have no grace. This is a test. It may not work. That's the point of a test. And he's so upset about it that they give him no grace. They're like, yeah, you really screwed up, Worf.
It's like, it's kind of mean. Time.
Yeah, it's kind of mean.
Well, I think it also, it's funny because it's just kind of like a rando problem that like doesn't ever really pay off either. But I guess it's put there to frustrate him so he can show the aggression rising.
Yes.
You know, it does. Kind of the first,
yes, it does get paid off in the scene where Barkley is really hyper in the engine room, in engineering. Yeah. And that we're supposed to understand that animals have been messing with the hardware. And that's why the system doesn't work. So that's
right.
But you're right. It's mainly there as a way to get Worf into being cranky. Mm-hmm. Does Worf really need a reason to be cranky, though? Mm-hmm. I don't know. So.
He gets like Zen for a little while, doesn't he?
That's true.
I feel like he has some Zen moments. Was it in that season or is it?
Picard season 3 is when he's firmly in the Zen warrior situation.
Which I kind of liked. I liked that.
Yeah, that was good. I did. I thought it was good. So those are my worst Trek tropes. Any more for you?
I don't think so. You're like really good at that, though. Like, for me, it's stuff like the close-up on Picard before the...
I love those. Any of those you were like, I was expecting this and it didn't happen. That would have been great. Yeah, there was no movement.
No, like seriously, this one flowed so nicely that like I was like, wait, it's over? Wow, that was so quick. I mean, it's what, 40, usually 42 minutes or something like that?
About 44, yeah, I think. As the franchise goes on, they do get shorter, but yeah. All right, most of it's time quality. So something from like the 90s that really stands out to you is like, that's clearly from the time it was made. Either an idea or a hairstyle or set dressing, something like that.
Always Deanna's hair is always 90s. So 90s, the hair that she has, like whatever style it is, it's always like,
you're like, yeah,
super 90s there. And even like, I would say, although you didn't really see much of Dr. Crusher, but her makeup's pretty 90s.
How so? I wouldn't know anything about that.
Like, just a lot of the copper eyeshadow. It's just very heavy and like matte. Everything's really matte. It's hard to explain. It's not like teenage 90s. It's like, you know, mature woman 90s makeup. But
I see.
I mean, still looks really good. She's gorgeous. So, but let's see what else.
Also, to show up on the TV screens of the time too, you probably had to go a little harder on some of that makeup.
The low def, all the low def. She always, she looks amazing. They all look good.
Of course. Yeah.
But those are the main things that stand out to me, is usually the hairstyles, because the uniforms are, I mean, I guess the fact that the women's uniforms are so tight, I guess that's, but is that a 90s thing or is that just like a non-evolved Star Trek thing?
Right. Mine was, although introns and junk DNA are not actually synonymous, they do get conflated a lot, to the point where I'm putting junk DNA is of its time, because actually in the last few years, the broad thinking about what junk DNA is doing in there is actually not what it was at the time this was written. So at the time this was written, it's basically what he says in the show, was that we have all the stuff that's left over, holdovers from evolution. Mm-hmm. And the thinking was like, that doesn't serve a purpose anymore. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to read a bit from Quantum Magazine. I promise to read this quickly, but cells use some of their non-coding DNA to create a diverse menagerie of RNA molecules that regulate or assist with protein production in various ways. The catalog of these molecules keeps expanding, with small nuclear RNAs, microRNAs, small interfering RNAs, and many more. But all of them can bind selectively to a target to either promote or inhibit translation into a protein. These RNAs have substantial effects on an organism's well-being. Experimental shutdowns of certain microRNAs in mice, for instance, have induced disorders ranging from tremors to liver dysfunction. Basically, the thinking is on junk DNA is that it's not left over. It's basically, even if it's not a pillar, it's part of the foundation of the house of our DNA, of our genome and all that stuff. So it serves a purpose. And if you start pulling it out like Jenga tiles or something, we're not going to be what we are. At the time this episode was written, though, it's basically, you know, you're reading a Nova magazine or something, or watching a Nova, or reading a science magazine, and Brandon Braga is going, huh, interesting. We all carry spider and amphibian DNA in us. So what if that got turned on? So.
Yeah, there's a lot. It's interesting. There's a lot of common DNA between species that you wouldn't think. But it makes sense. If we've evolved from certain things, why wouldn't it still be part of that building block?
Yeah, on the same planet. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now it's time for the line must be drawn here. Great lines. any great lines you want to spotlight?
You start.
All right. Well, since this has stuck with me for 30 years, Worf. Open your mouth. and then Picard, because I use this in the intro. Well, before I begin swinging through the ship looking for breakfast, we need to find some answers. It's very rare that Jean-Luc Picard is given a joke line, that he would even attempt a joke. And I just appreciate it in that moment. It's, you know, it's an episode that I think Gates McFadden did everything she could to make this as entertaining as possible. And I think the script was pretty perfunctory at the end of the day. Like, it was so heavy on its concept and making sure that all the setups were paid off, or like how we got certain elements were set up, that I think any moment of mirth or whimsy was few and far between. So just Picard making a joke in that situation was funny to me. I think it stands out.
Throw something in there. Yeah. That's, I mean, right. I like when Barclay is like, well, has she found a place? Yes. You know, I love that whole bit where he's like, well, usually they find a place that is dark and private to give birth. Or I don't remember exactly how he said it, but I found that really funny.
Yeah. No, it's a total cat boy, that mm-hmm. Barkley. the Anton Caridian Award for Best Performance. So I'm very curious to hear who you think deserves the number one performance medal here.
Wow. Well, I mean, Michael Dorn, he really committed to that monster for sure.
He did. He had to play all the shades of Worf.
yeah, which probably was really fun for him, I imagine. And then Marina Sirtis playing an amphibian. Like, you do that, and like, seriously, you do stuff like that in acting class. Like, you're a scorpion, you know, now crawl, you know, and you act like an animal. But to like lay in the water like that and make these like fish motions.
Yeah, she's going
mouth and.
Yeah, she's like breathing and she's got the fingertips on the edge of the tub. Yeah, it's great.
I thought, I mean, even though it didn't require a lot of dialogue, I thought it was really impressive.
Yeah. So, all right. I'm fine with that. Can I give I have to give her some sort of standout though. So
okay.
It's not a co-medal. I want to give an honorable mention, the strongest possible honorable mention to Gates McFadden, because not only does she do the scream, I'm getting past the scream, I promise everybody, but I love that scene in her acting in the teaser where she's treating everyone. She treats Riker a certain way. By the way, we didn't even really get into that. Riker gets needles from a plant in his back that gets pulled out.
Oh, right.
But he's specifically saying, I was fraternizing with someone underneath me. I was trying to hook up with the new tactical officer.
Yes.
Could have played that up and she could have been in the episode. That might have been fun when he's like de-evolving and it gets tribal on the bridge suddenly, but that would have been a different episode. Anyway, but like he's telling a story and she's kind of going like, okay. And then with Barkley, she's like, I'm going to be nice to you, but you're crazy. And then with Data, but I love her reaction to Nurse Ogawa announcing she's pregnant. She's like, she's so excited for her. I thought that was great. And then I really think because she directed so well, like Gates McFadden, like it was cool in the sickbay scene where they're all huddled around the cats and Ogawa makes the announcement. It's very rare we get to see Dr. Crusher's office in the same shot. Like it was a wide enough lens where, you know, she's catching basically all of sickbay from that one corner of the room. And then when Picard and Data get on the ship, we get a full establishing shot of the shuttle bay, the second level included and the bottom level. I don't know. It's just we're seven seasons in. It's nice that an actor is able to find a little bit different look than we're kind of used to seeing. And, I think she just knew where to put the camera in this one, which I think a lot of directors who've done enough Star Treks, they think this is where we can do it to get it done in the time I need to get it done in. But she was just like, I know we can do this because she has the confidence and she's great.
Yeah.
I think she deserves some form of recognition, but I really do actually like your choices because Worf and Troy's transformations were the most severe and they sold them so well. Like it makes the episode weird and creepy and all that stuff because of them.
I know that fish, I can't, like, yeah. I know she wasn't a fish, but just the way that she, but no, Gates McFadden for sure. Like she directed the whole thing, like good grief. Yeah.
So then though, the Shatner, who do you have as who really went for it, which doesn't have to be like overacting like William Shatner gets accused of, but like, just, you know, they really went for it.
Barkley.
Yeah, that's right.
Barkley did. He was like, I am a spider.
The venom. I love the way Jonathan Frakes is just being slow. Like, you're saying that Worf is spraying his venom. He's just scratching. It's great. That's absolutely. He could probably get it every time he's in an episode. In fact.
Well, and just like the way that he, like, when he jumps up and Picard sees him, it's like.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. I'm a spider.
I'm a spider. Oh, what part of this episode will they teach at Starfleet Academy?
Oh, they'll probably teach about that virus, I would think, right?
Yeah, Barkley's protomorphosis syndrome for sure, but which is what the virus gets named at the end. But I would also think in that chapter, they'd be like, maybe don't go injecting people willy-nilly with synthetic T-cells.
Definitely.
And then not closely monitor them. Seems like maybe Dr. Crusher was a little reckless because of who the patient was. She was like, what will get him out of here quickly?
Yeah, which it doesn't really seem like something she normally would do. She's
but Barkley does have a way of getting under people's skins.
Yeah, and just anything to get you away.
Almost so, like a perfect storm of situation.
But I mean, they already teach at Starfleet Academy that the captain shouldn't leave the ship, so.
Well, once he decides to leave the ship, you can't really like hold him there. It's like,
no, that's true. You have to still follow his command. So if he decides to leave, then but he's not supposed to.
Yeah. Right. Could this episode have been hornier and would that have made it better?
No.
Yeah. That's
It could have been, but it wouldn't have made it better.
I think the horniness led to sexual assault in this one. I think we're good. We got the horniness covered.
Sexual assault in the 90s too, which people are probably like, oh, that's hot. But like, it just, now
I think it got transmuted into the bite, which is not in of itself really hot. I think there is, if it had been a human on human, then yes, it would have been, you know, that would have been easier. But I think the fact that it's like animalistic and alien on top of it is a step move.
It helps, like, not, but I was like, whoa, like, I just remember watching it and being like, that is okay. Back in the day, it probably didn't bug people so much, but not that it bothered
me. No, I think it did. I think it's supposed to be upsetting, and it is. I don't think that's a 30
year. They bite each other, right?
Yes. And so when we watch Klingon rituals, both are consenting parties, but there's like, it's a weird alien struggle we're watching, right? We're not watching helpless Deanna Troi in a bathtub. And like, they're both going through something that they don't understand. You know what I mean? It's supposed to be horrifying. I think it works out.
Yeah.
All right. So Trek, marry or kill Genesis. Trek means good, great, or good. Yeah. Marry is like, this is like an all timer Star Trek episode. And then kill, we love all Star Trek, but kill is like, I saw it once. I don't need to see it again. Or they shouldn't have made it.
this episode?
Yeah, those? Well, that's what I'm wondering. Is it a Trek, marry, or kill?
I think it's a Trek for me. I mean, marry would be like Inner Light, you know?
So. Sure, yeah. Yeah, which we have not done yet on the show. This one, I couldn't believe when I saw that factoid about that book that said that Genesis was one of the worst. I don't agree. I think it's definitely a very solid Trek in large part. Well, I think Gates McFadden and Michael Westmore are the MVPs of the episode. If the makeup looks like crap, I think that hurts it. Mm-hmm. And I think if Gates McFadden doesn't do yeoman's work, or, you know, she's not yeoman, she's very, she knows how to direct something. And then it just comes down to, she knows how to direct actors and drama. Then it was just a matter of figuring out the best place to put the cameras. And when you've worked on the same sets, this is a bottle episode. When you've worked on the same sets for 7 years or 6 years in her case, you have a pretty good understanding of the space and how to use it. So, it's kind of hard to argue that this one, it, like, everyone remembers that there was an episode where the crew de-evolved. Even if they don't remember the specifics, they remember that Barkley turned into a spider, or Spot turned into an iguana, or, you know, Worf sprang venom, or they remember some part of this episode because it's so wild. To that end, do you think this is a big swing that connected?
A big swing that connected?
Yeah, we're kind of looking at Star Trek in this part of our season of Trek, Marry, Kill. Star Trek Strange New World second season, their mission statement for the season was big swings. We're going to take the biggest swings Star Trek has ever seen. And we're kind of trying to go like, well, there have been big swings before, prior to Strange New World season two. And like, they've done really wild ideas. And I kind of think Genesis qualifies as a really wild idea.
For sure. It's definitely out of the norm, but in a good way.
So you think it connects then? We think it worked out.
Definitely.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's a Trek for Genesis. Heidi, thanks so much for playing Trek, Marry, Kill with this one. Is there anything that you want people to check out or be on the lookout for?
Sure. I mean, my company you talked about already, Dweeb Darlings. You can always still watch Stalking LeVar. It's on YouTube. We also made a short film that's based on the similar storyline called Chasing Fletcher Allen, but that actually isn't available to be seen yet because it was in festivals for a while. I recently, like, not recently, but it recently finally was released, was the short film Rock In that I did with James Hong.
Oh, cool.
It was like a little horror comedy.
Yeah,
that was super fun. And there's a couple of scripts that we're trying to get made. I finished a feature recently with a writing partner, a short film that I want to shoot about. It's a little more serious. It's not like a comedy like normally what I make, but it's more about religious abuse. So, you know, and I'm part of a female filmmaker nonprofit called the Chimera Project. So all you women filmmakers out there, you can always go check that out too. I think it's chimerafilms.org. And there's all kinds of different programs that we have and ways that we're trying to help, kind of do exactly what Dweeb Darlings wants to do as well, which is just support women filmmakers and get more content out there that is made by women. So I'm glad you chose this episode to talk about the one that Yates McFadden directed. That was perfect for me.
Yeah. And hopefully it's a shame she never directed a horror movie just on her own too, though, then, because she did do a great job in this one. But yes, fantastic company you have and really inspiring. And hey, great job, Yates McFadden, making us talk about this episode still 30 years later. That's to me the great mark of an artist, is when you talk about their work for years after it comes out.
Absolutely.
Next week, I'm going to be joined by Michael Bauman to judge another big swing, but from Strange New Worlds, season 2, Among the Lotus Eaters. If you're so inclined, consider rating us 5 stars wherever you listen to the show. What was your husband's podcast name for people to check out there?
Geekscape, GEEKSCAPE, geekscape.net. But you can find it.
Yeah, check easily. Out that. Check out Dweeb Darlings. Check us out on social media at Trek Mary K-Pod. And thanks for listening. Until next week, TMK out.